The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League. Big Sam finally lets West Brom off the leash. And how? Scything Chelsea apart at every opportunity. Sweeping passing moves, glorious side foot volleys from the edge of the box. Classic Allardyce. It's honours even in El Jurassico, Bruce versus Jose, as Newcastle become the latest team to score late against Spurs. To be clear, it is nothing to do with Mourinho. Newcastle worse than Fulham, still above Fulham though, who lose at Villa. Elsewhere, Liverpool swat Arsenal aside. Good comebacks for Southampton and Manchester United, and a really lovely pass from Kevin De Bruyne. Sid will join us after yet another poorly handled racist incident on the pitch, while less importantly, the title race takes another twist. There's some Champions League to look forward to, a lovely overhead kick in Italy, and an even more glorious miss in the Championship. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. AB writes, same host, different guests, a better or worse pod than last week. Well, clearly, AB, it is nothing to do with me. Whatever happens on the pod today, absolutely, I bear no responsibility for the quality of it. Unless, of course, it's really good. Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max. How are you?
Yeah, I'm marvellous. Thank you. Philippe Auclair, bonjour, ça va?
Ça va et toi?
Hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Come on, Max.
Forgive me for not knowing hello, how are you in Norwegian.
That's fine. I mean, what do you want me to add?
Well, you can tell me what it is.
Maybe I should teach you. Hello, hello, or good morning.
Oh, it's such a what a beautiful sort of.
It's the language of love.
It is. It's sort of tuneful, isn't it? It sort of bounces along. Yes. It does sound a lot like when Barry's had too many on a train and pretends to be the Swedish chef from Sesame. Is it the Muppets or Sesame
the
Street?
The Muppet Show.
Muppets.
From the Muppet Show. But anyway. That's for off air, Barry, isn't it? Chelsea 2, West Brom 5. This, Barry, was a ridiculous game of football. And West Brom were extraordinarily good. And I certainly didn't see it coming.
No, I don't think anyone did. Anyone who said they saw this coming is a liar. I mean, it was the first game back after an international break. I was looking forward to it. Haven't been looking forward to Premier League weekends for a while. But I was looking forward to this one. And it really came back with not so much a bang as a sonic boom. It crossed my mind. I'm not going to say I thought it would happen, but it crossed my mind that if there was a time to catch Chelsea, it was after an international break on the Saturday lunchtime kickoff, and that duly happened. Chelsea took the lead. Then they had a man sent off. I don't think that should have made the difference it did. I would normally back Chelsea to beat West Brom with 10 men over 90 minutes if they were only allowed to start with 10 men. I'd still back them to win that game. But as Thomas Tuchel said afterwards, they just could not handle it. And I think the Branislav Ivanovic cameo, as funny as it was, he came on for Dar O'Shea, had to do one sprint in 10 minutes, and that did for him. So he came off, and because Chelsea had been reduced to 10 men at that point, instead of sending on another defender, Sam Allardyce opted to bring on Callum Robinson, and he proved to be an absolute revelation. Not the Callum Robinson I'm used to seeing playing for the Republic of Ireland, I have to say. But West Brom, they mullered Chelsea. They scored several fantastic goals. Two of them coming from Robinson, two wonderful finishes, a brilliant team goal. And needless to say, at the end of it, Big Sam looked like the cat who'd got the cream.
He really did, just grinning away, sitting in the dugout. Philippe, that Callum Robinson volley is such a thing of beauty, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's the way he also has to get airborne to execute it absolutely perfectly. And it's one of those occasions, you know, we're always saying, oh, slow-mo is ruining the game. Well, not on this occasion. It's just absolutely magnificent. To be honest, yes, has he ever scored a goal like that before, Callum Robinson? Is he a specialist of this kind of... I don't know.
What, of a side foot volley from edge of the box without breaking stride, playing for a Big Sam team? I mean, it seems unlikely, doesn't it?
Zinedine Robinson.
Yeah.
Absolutely magnificent.
And possibly, Lars, it wasn't even their best goal. I mean, I think it was, but Deanne's finish from a lovely move was great as well.
Yeah, extraordinary team goal, sort of flowing move. And it's, I have to say, Chelsea handled this whole situation very, very badly. I mean, they went into the game having conceded two in the last 14, playing against a team that I think had scored one in five. So a 5-2 drubbing is, of course, what you expect from West Brom. That's very odd all around. But I think there's something about... They've been keeping these clean sheets, Chelsea, not by, you know, defending stoutly, you know, backs against the wall, here we go. It's been by keeping the ball and taking the sting out of the game and just sort of death by football, as Brendan Rodgers would call it. But and that's a very hard thing to do when you're one man down. You know, it becomes a very, very different thing. And they had to play slightly differently, I think, and they weren't able to do it.
I think there's also last the fact that they were missing the best defensive midfielder in the world, because he is that again. And you can see that the importance of N'Golo Kanté being injured with France, and the way that the midfield didn't... I'm sure that if N'Golo had been on the pitch, you would have seen quite a different reaction from Chelsea. Because to go back to what Barry was saying, the fact of going down to 10 men, where you're 1-0 up, what I couldn't understand is how they fell apart completely. That is very odd. Normally, you wouldn't expect that at all from this kind of Chelsea side.
Sure, and actually, the first goal they concede is we talked about West Brom's beautiful goals, and it was a nice finish, but it was just Sam Johnson humping it long. You know, presumably, that was the goal that Big Sam was happiest about during the game. Is it too late for West Brom to stay up, Barry? They're, 19th, 8 points off Newcastle.
I think it probably is, but they've given themselves a much better chance than they had before this game. It's difficult to envisage them playing this well again, to say the least. I must confess, I haven't looked at their running, but...
They're playing Southampton.
I would also say it's difficult to see Newcastle playing as well as they did against Spurs again. Fulham don't seem to be getting the results, are still not getting the results some of their performances deserve. They've given themselves a chance, a slim chance.
What I would say is there's something slightly bittersweet about it. And I noticed, I mean, we all know that Sam would have been delighted and was enjoying his time and all of this, but in his press interview, he also made a big point of how it's been frustrating because we haven't played as well as we could have in some games, and they have actually just lost two in the last seven. So, I mean, the improvement that you pay the big money for when you bring in Big Sam is coming. It's just come a little bit too late for them. And, I mean, there is a team there that could have stayed up, I think, but they're running out of road. And I don't think they'll do it. But I think if they had just four or five more games, I think they could have done it, which must be very frustrating for them.
Thomas Tuchel was forced to send Antonio Rudiger home from training early after he was involved in a heated dispute with Kepa Arrizabalaga less than 24 hours before the game. Tuchel says, can you play the which team will he score against next game for Timo Werner to try and get him back into form? They've got Porto on Wednesday night. Will Timo Werner score? Anyone?
Nope. No.
Palace away on Saturday.
Okay.
Porto at home on Tuesday the 13th.
I'd say yes.
Okay, we have one from Philippe. The 17th of April, Man City at home. Tuesday the 20th, home to Brighton. Come on. just to end the feature would be good. West Ham away on the 24th of April.
Okay, I'll go for that just to put an end to this.
Okay, Lars, you don't
Timo
you don't
Werner
get to go,
is
Lars.
Not that bad a player. He scored 10 goals this season. He scored three or four for Germany as well this season. And he's created quite a lot for Chelsea. He's a good player. He will score goals. I mean, that is an absolute guarantee.
Okay. And actually, he did well to set up Mount, because it would have been very easy for someone out of form just to try and score. But he did the right thing in getting that consolation goal. Let's go then to St. James's Park. Newcastle 2, Spurs 2. Nathan says, now that Newcastle are competing with the likes of Spurs, does that not mean their fans should be happy? Look, Newcastle were much better. I think they had 22 shots, which is more shots than they've had in a game for years, I think it is, since they played maybe Huddersfield. Their XG was more than four. And look, they deserved at least a point Lars, against the garbage that is Tottenham.
Well, you put it very succinctly there, Max. No, you're right. I mean, maybe this is very harsh, but it was one of those performances that there was fight there, there was no shortage of ability there. And it was one of those games where you look at Newcastle United and you think, why are they 1 point above the drop zone? Why are they so heavily involved in this relegation battle? And if you want to be very critical of Steve Bruce, you can even use this result as a stick to beat him with, because you can suggest that this is a team that should be higher up the table. But then again, that is very harsh, because then you end into come into a situation where even good games become a negative for Steve Bruce, which feels very unfair.
Well, it's very Newcastle, isn't it? So it's exactly that. But at last, you could say that of many of the teams at the bottom. Fulham.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brighton probably should be, well, come on. Brighton should be higher than they are. You know, West Brom, as we've said, you know, played like Brazil. Actually, they played in the colours of Brazil. But I was more intrigued by Mourinho yet again. And I think there will be, you know, in the compendium of Mourinho quotes, there will be a whole chapter with quotes from this season. Because the more it goes, the more impenetrable they become.
Yeah, so asked by Juliet Farrington on Five Live why Spurs can't hold on to Leeds, which is unlike previous Jose teams, he said, same coach, different players. And then when pushed on, he said, I don't want to talk about it. Run away. So basically, he's fine. It's just he doesn't have any good players, Philippe.
Well, he also said... he was asked, you know, about Alderweireld and Serge Aurier, who managed to come back late from international duty, missed out on their COVID tests, so therefore were not available, though fit. And he was asked if indiscipline was to blame. And he said, I don't want to say indiscipline. I don't want to say discipline. It's very, very odd. It's getting odder and odder. And they were execrable. I think we could take a thesaurus and look for... synonyms of that expression, of that adjective, and they would probably apply to what we saw of Tottenham. And I mean, to be honest, Lars, is because I'm going, if I talk about Tottenham like this, people are going to think, you know what? So Lars,
yes, Philippe,
as a disinterested witness of what is happening in what I think is your club, what have you got to say?
Mm-hmm. I mean. Where do you begin? You mentioned the Alderweireld not disciplined thing. I mean, they put out a video from training from Friday in which he was training. So this sort of thing, he didn't make the COVID tests because he came back late. It's very odd because he has been training with the squad. Seems like such a bizarre thing to lie about. But I think we are, in any sort of Jose Mourinho tenure in any club, there comes a point where things are not going well and Mourinho sort of switches gears a little bit and becomes more interested in defending his own brand than being a good leader to the players he's actually being paid to be in charge of. And when you look at his public utterances at Tottenham, it's very clear that we're at this point now. But I would sort of, and it's clear what he's doing with this sort of same coach, different players thing, but I would put it to you that perhaps he has stumbled onto a good point here. Because maybe, based on how it's gone at United, where, oh no, he never had the right players and it wasn't his fault, and that Tottenham, oh no, he doesn't have the right players, it's not his fault. Maybe he's actually not that good and never has been. I mean, maybe he has been given way too much credit. I mean, he's arguing that, you know, there were different players before when he won things. And that's true. You know, so maybe actually we're dramatically underestimating the impact the players had when he was successful. It certainly seems that he's not able to be successful without having just the exact players that he wants, which is fair enough. But it does raise the question of why anyone would ever pay him 50 million a year to be a coach. Because if he could only work with the best players, I mean, a lot of coaches can be successful if they have the best players. Presumably he's there to improve the ones he's in charge of. But he doesn't seem very interested in that.
With regard to the same coach, different players, I mean, the back four yesterday, Reguilón, Rodon, Sanchez, Tanganga, at least two of them were signed on his watch, and he gave Tanganga his debut, if I'm not mistaken. So,
well, it's interesting. Theo Delaney from, you know, he's a big Spurs fan, does the Spurs show and the Life Goals podcast, said, look, this is what happens when the boss picks the most callow back four available to make some kind of point about the senior players not doing what he tells them. Jose's ego dictates team selection. which seems quite fair, doesn't it? I mean, you wonder if he does... He's almost trying to work out his excuses with the team he selects. I mean, that seems mad.
You can't be surprised. This is what Mourinho does. Like, this is who he is. He is right. It is the same coach. This is what Tottenham signed up for. So, you know, this is what they have.
Yeah, it's just so painfully slow to watch. It's just, it's not just the defender. You know, they dropped 13 points from winning positions in the last 15 minutes of games this season. You knew that equaliser was coming, but it's the way they attack, which is just so deliberate and painfully slow.
I think, and I know Newcastle fans are very reluctant to give Steve Bruce any credit whatsoever, but I think he does deserve some for yesterday's performance. He set up in a formation I suspect Tottenham weren't expecting. Two strikers playing side by side. Definitely got the best out of Joe Ellington, who scored against Tottenham again. I was at on my only visit to Tottenham's new stadium. He scored in a 1-0 win for Newcastle, and he brought Jacob Murphy in for a rare start, and Matt Ritchie was brought in from his period out in the cold after he fell out with Bruce, and they gave Reguilon and Tanganga all sorts of problems on the wings. And I think, you know, just crossing balls into to Joe Ellington and Dwight Gayle, that works, you know. Newcastle playing further up the pitch works. Alan Shearer said on Match of the Day too, they've set themselves a standard now that they have to maintain for the rest of the season. And they have a horrible run of fixtures coming up. So it will be interesting to see if this is just one of those occasional good performances by Newcastle, which is followed by several bad ones.
They also talked on Match of the Day too about Harry Kane and what he does, because his numbers are ridiculous and he should be playing for a better team. I mean, there's just no doubt. And if he did play for a better team, as I think it was Alan Shearer, I think they both said, him and Ian, right, look, it's just a guarantee. He always delivers.
He should not necessarily play for a better club, but he should play for a better team. That's the point. And it's a big nuance to make, because it's not the question that the club is not big enough for him or anything like that. It's a question that this team is underperforming. I mean, come on, you have you seen the bench they had for this game against Newcastle? It's absolutely ridiculous. Joe Hart, Eric Dier, Harry Winks, Moussa Sissoko, Dele Alli, Eric Lamela, Gareth Bale, and Heung-Min Son. This is on the bench.
It's better than the starting 11.
I mean, it's extraordinary. I can't get my head around it. It still obviously hasn't found... It's not a question of even finding a first 11. I don't know how he thinks they should be playing. And I don't think they know either. They have very little idea. I mean, where is the team that honestly, for me, produced the best performance of the season against Manchester City? Where's that team gone?
Good question. Don't know. Well, look, Newcastle are 3 points ahead of Fulham with a game in hand, because Fulham lost to Aston Villa despite going ahead. Opta Joe's stat was nice. Aston Villa Fulham, the first game in Premier League history in which every player in the starting 11 for both sides was born after the first ever Premier League game on August the 15th, 1992. Barry, this game was all about Trezeguet, wasn't it? Coming off the bench, scoring twice, seemed to have about 12 other shots as well, but he was brilliant.
Yeah, Fulham looked to be in control of the game, and Villa's substitutions, Keenan Davis and Trezeguet, came on, I think, shortly after the hour mark and completely turned it on its head. Trezeguet, he's a player, he's not really on my radar, I have to say, but he certainly is now, and scored two terrific goals. And Fulham are also running out of road, as Lars said. You know, I thought before Christmas they were showing, you know, they really electroshocked themselves into life after a terrible start, and I thought they'd be fine, but they're just not. That is a game they really should have won and needed to win, and they also have tricky fixtures coming up, so I would be worried about them.
But do you think, Philippe, we're going to keep saying Fulham are better than Newcastle and therefore will stay up until the end of the season when Fulham go down and Newcastle don't, and we all say, yes, but Fulham are better?
I genuinely fear it. But the fact is, they are playing much better than what they're... It's a fact. Yeah, you're worried because you thought they had given themselves a fighting chance to get out of this, but the way things are going around them is not very encouraging, to say the least.
Philippe, you know, you're sort of saying, look, Fulham are playing better than their position and West Brom should probably be higher and Newcastle should probably be higher. Who's in the vacuum? What's the vacuum from 19th to 16th? Should there be no teams there? How does it work?
I don't know. I'm wondering which teams should be on the quality of their play. Actually, that's the question. Which teams on the quality of their play should be in the bottom three and deserve to be in the bottom three?
Sheffield United, West Brom and Newcastle are the three worst teams in the Premier League,
well,
in
Crystal
my opinion.
Palace have done well there, haven't they? In terms of,
have a weirdly higher number of points.
Is the question the teams that you most want to see when you see they're on and you turn the telly on and you think, they're playing? Should those be the three that go down?
Well, then it would be Burnley, West Brom, and Palace.
I think Sheffield United has already been forgotten about. That's it. They're gone.
I mean, for Palace, you watch it for Zaha and Eze, right? Who can always do some fun stuff. But you kind of want one or both of them to move somewhere where they get to attack more in the future. On Fulham, this was the kind of game, certainly I felt watching it, where you just thought, oh God, they're going to get relegated, aren't they? And I say that with a very heavy heart, because I believe so much in the Fulham revival, Max. I've talked about it a lot on the pod, how I think they'll get out of it, because they are playing well. And they've had a season... Like Philippe says, so many games they've not gotten what they deserved, but here they were 1-0 up against Aston Villa, who've been really struggling without Jack Grealish. They've been struggling for goals. I think they've scored twice in the last five or something, and suddenly they concede three out of nothing in the second half. And that's the kind of stuff if you can't get anything from that kind of position, you're not going to stay in the league.
Just one last thing on this game about Trezeguet, because a lot of the strange results we've had, not just in England but all through Europe, will be put on the account of players being away with their national teams, having to travel, the COVID testing and so forth. Trezeguet was Egypt. He actually started both Egypt's games against Kenya and Comoros, and it certainly didn't show.
And the only other thought on that game is I hope Tyrone Mings doesn't do that for England in the Euros.
Oh,
I just had a sort of a flash forward to just the Scotland game and just a slightly stubbed pass back to a flailing Nick Pope as Che Adams runs through and we go and it makes it 1-1 and the draw isn't enough. Oh, God. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start at Old Trafford. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's stay down the bottom. Brighton and Burnley not totally out of trouble. Brighton were one up against Manchester United. They lost. Good comeback for Manchester United. But I did feel for Brighton, Baz, in this game.
Yeah, I didn't think they did a huge amount wrong, to be honest. Manchester United are just better than they are. And I was trying to pick a hole in Brighton's performance. I couldn't really. I think their goalkeeper could probably have done a bit better for both goals. And beyond that, it was just Manchester United were a classier outfit than them. And their superiority showed in the end. But yeah, Brighton didn't do a great deal wrong. They played well, lost. These things happen.
Nifty Palm says, is Harry Maguire the only player who's allowed to foul in the box and get away with it? Did it against Chelsea as well, I think.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that, actually. Brighton,
yeah, it was his 100th game. So maybe on your 100th game, you can do what you like. It's difficult, isn't it? You don't want to spend the whole time talking about decisions, but it's 1-1, and it really does look like a foul.
Of course it was, yeah.
It is a foul.
Yes, it is. Okay, you're right.
And there is no attempt to play the ball, which means that it is a red card. There is no double jeopardy here.
Do you think you overturn it? You overturn it because of how confidently Maguire did a finger shake.
I mean, if I was a ref, that would be an immediate red card. I mean, if he did that finger wag after I'd made a decision, I wouldn't even go to the VAR monitor. Just go away. You're
it's
off.
Quite a difficult thing to do, actually, as emphatically as he did it. It's almost as if he practices.
But like, I think it's more with the wrist than just with the finger, don't you think?
But by the way, this is one thing I find very odd. Why isn't there more of a moral panic about this? Because he will have known he's fouled him. Like, he will have known he grabbed him by the shoulder and dragged him down. Yeah, he turns around and does that finger wag. I mean, how is that less dishonest than diving, for instance?
Oh, because you need to look at the worst things you can do in football, and diving is just below turning your back at a free kick and obviously spitting, which isn't pleasant.
Okay.
And then it's that kind of dishonesty is further down the list, you know. You would rather have your legs broken than be spat at.
That's not true.
So there's more moral fiber in breaking somebody's leg.
Exactly right.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for clearing this up.
I did notice for Brighton's goal that, you know, Danny Welbeck got in front of Aaron Wan-Bissaka quite easily. And obviously, there's currently a huge furore going on about the right backs of England. We'll get on to Trent Alexander-Arnold at one point, but I imagine Gareth Southgate he had a sigh of relief when a right back he hasn't picked did something badly, because that's what he needs to happen for the rest of the season.
Max, I'm sorry, I just still want to stress that Manchester United, which Barry described as a classy outfit, were absolute tripe for 50 minutes. and that their first shot on target was Marcus Rashford in the 52nd minute. So they carry on in their merry way, which is our unmerry way. And
So are you saying, Philippe, that they're not good enough to be second? And so you're just trying to suck all the teams into mid-table. You've got City, Sheffield United, and then just like...
Yes, a kind of one of these massive black holes in which even light disintegrates into nothingness. With maximum mass and energy, that's where the Premier League really is.
And on that subject, let's move on to Burnley.
Gary says, "Did any of the pod have Southampton Burnley as the first game to be on Match of the Day 2? This was super fun, Lars, wasn't it?
Yes, it was tremendous fun. I jest, but it was. And I thought Ralf Hasenhüttl was in a jovial mood, as he would be, and says a kind of game that's good for broadcasters but bad for the manager's heart. And I think that summed it up really well. It's good to see Southampton win games again. It's not been a great season for them. They've had a ton of injuries, and I like the fact that they just keep trying to play the way they play, and then that they're very attack-minded and forward thinking, all of this. It's tremendous.
Danny Ings scored a lovely goal. It's very hard to know where he's just one of those good players that'll probably miss out on the Euro squad, or do you think he'll make it?
I'd say he'll miss out. I would imagine it would be Harry Kane and Dominic Calvert-Lewin would be the first two strikers, and I wonder if Gareth Southgate will even bring a third striker because he's got Marcus Rashford and Raheem Sterling. So I don't know if he needs three out-and-out strikers.
So presumably Southgate would have been devastated to see Danny Ings sweep past Ben Mee, cut back and slide it in the corner, because he doesn't need these players playing well.
And you've got James Ward-Prowse in the squad as well, who's another one who's like, well, you'd imagine will probably miss out on the squad in the end, but you know, he's really good and probably deserves to be there.
Yeah, I agree. Mateo Vidra's goal was one of the most Burnley goals of all time. It was beautiful, wasn't it? It was a beautiful version of that goal. You know, big man flick on, little man finish. Richard Jolly's stat on that goal. Matej Vidra joins Jeffrey Schlupp as the top scorer in the Premier League this season, whose surname begins with four consonants. So that's important to know, isn't it? Chris Wood could have got a point late on, was having his shirt pulled. I forget who was pulling the shirt, but they didn't finger wag enough for it to be automatically overturned. And it probably should have been a penalty, but it wasn't. That's what happens sometimes. Arsenal 0, Liverpool 3. No Premier League game has delivered more goals than Arsenal-Liverpool's. C122 says, should Arsenal have to do pre-qualifiers to face Liverpool? I mean, as I said to Barry yesterday, the sign of Liverpool's dominance in this game was that I didn't notice Alisson's moustache until the second half, because the ball hadn't been near him. And what a wonderful thing it is. Liverpool were really good in this game, Philippe. And it's interesting how people have...
They were really good. They were made to look really good. It was the best confidence booster before their Champions League game. Arsenal were to use an old Alan Hansen adjective, diabolical. There was absolutely nothing to them, no substance, no threat, no solidity. Even players who had been satisfaction so far this season had an off day. One of them was not an off day. Gabriel had probably the worst game he will ever have all through his life. It was extraordinary. It was almost as if he was daring the attacker he was supposed to mark to have a start on him to see if he could catch up with him. And of course, that didn't happen. It was absolutely awful. So yes, in a way, they found some of their mojo back. But I would really temper that with the fact that in front of them was the Arteta team, which produced the worst games of the Arteta era, and a team which obviously was missing big time Bukayo Saka and Emil Smith Rowe, which is something to say about a team when you're missing two guys who are about 9 years old when you put their ages together, and thinking already about their game in the Europa League, which is the only way they're going to salvage anything from this season. So, yes, Liverpool were good, and the good in exploiting the weaknesses and the no-show of the team that they were confronting.
Philippe, as an Arsenal fan, what's your sort of where's the Arteta pendulum swinging currently?
I think it all depends on Thursday and the Thursday after that. And yes, it's all going to be judged on the Europa League. What happens in the Europa League? For the rest, it's frustrating because there are green shoots of recovery, Max, but those green shoots have yet to, well, I wouldn't say germinate, but to grow into something more tree-like,
right?
More plant-like.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gabriel was quite tree-like, to be fair.
He was tree-like, yeah, absolutely. He looked a bit like he was like the Ents in Lord of the Rings at the beginning, where they're just reawaken after ages spent hibernating, and it was extraordinary. And I think like with Arteta, I think loads of people are starting to get a little bit bored with the idea of the grand project, the grand plan, because we can't really see what's going on. Oh, we should be more solid defensively speaking. Well, certainly not on this occasion. On the other hand, it must be said that he hasn't been very lucky with a squad that is quite thin. He's been hit at exactly the right point or the wrong point by injuries, suspensions, COVID and so forth at every single step. And again, when I say they really miss Bukayo Saka and Emil Smith Rowe, I'm not trying to, to make it sound better than it is, but to genuinely have such a thin squad. You know, I talked about the bench that Tottenham had in that draw against Newcastle. Look at the bench that Arsenal had against Liverpool, and to be honest, it's not very inspiring, to say the least.
I suppose it's not. They don't have a ton of injuries, but they have exactly the wrong injuries. I mean, if you look at this Arsenal,
and to the wrong personnel.
Yeah, if you look at this team and you take out four to really debilitate them. I mean, David Luiz, he gets mixed reviews, but he has generally been very good for Arsenal this season and is an important, character there. Same with Granit Xhaka, who I think does an important job in that midfield compared to what the other alternate options. And yeah, Saka and Smith Rowe have been the sort of the two big upsides going forward. So those are four players they really don't want to be without.
Lars, you're up on modern football parlance. Miguel Delaney tweeted something yesterday that Barry and I had never heard before, that Diogo Jota has scored five clutch goals for Liverpool this season. Match winners or game breakers, including in his last two games.
Is that not an American thing? I think that's an American thing from like American sports.
Apparently, it could be. I mean, I thought you'd furnish us with a supreme explanation.
Apparently, it's players who manage to score in at crucial times of the game, particularly in the dying minutes when the pressure is at its maximum.
Oh, right. Well, look, we have lots of listeners in America, so perhaps they can give us why clutch is clutch. Saves me looking it up anyway, doesn't it? Which I could have done before the podcast.
Liverpool were good. Before we move on, Liverpool good.
Yeah, really good, weren't they? Jota's coming. Jota was so good at the start of the season. He could make a big difference in that game with Real Madrid. And Salah, just the way Salah took that goal, it's like it's in slow motion and really fast. He's in slow motion, the rest of us aren't. And it was delightful, wasn't it? And obviously a big worry for Gareth Southgate because Trent Alexander-Arnold, Barry, did a really good cross.
Yes, he did. So he must travel the England party. I mean, okay, lots of people are getting very upset about Trent Alexander-Arnold's omission from England squad for the Euros, despite the fact it hasn't been picked yet. You'd have to say it doesn't look like he will make it, as he wasn't picked for the most recent squad, unless, of course, somebody else gets injured. And I totally get the logic of not bringing him. He is a fine player, there's no doubt about that, but he's never really played well for England. And in Kyle Walker and Kieran Trippier, Southgate has two more versatile players who can play as part of a back three if needed. And Reece James, it could be argued, has had a better season than Trent Alexander-Arnold. Gareth Southgate has explained this, but some of the doyens of English sports journalism and Gary Lineker said it on Match of the Day and on Twitter, they seem to think it would be an absolute aberration if Trent Alexander-Arnold wasn't brought. I think it's okay to think that Trent Alexander-Arnold is a terrific player, because he is, and it's also okay to understand why he might not be part of Southgate's plans for the Euros.
Well, when Reece James overhits a cross in the last minute against the Czech Republic.
A clutch cross, of course.
Mm. Exactly, yeah. It would be a clutch moment for that cross, and it won't happen, and it'll all be Gareth's fault. Man City won 2-0 at Leicester. Philippe, just talk about that Kevin De Bruyne pass. Go on.
Can we watch it instead? I've watched it a number of times and I still can't quite comprehend, because every time I watch it, I think, come on, one of those two players is bisecting, is bound to get it. But it's to the, I don't know, it's that the width of a shoelace, the ball evades them, because the weight and the pace of the ball, the trajectory, with just the right amount of a hint of a swerve as well. It's a little bit of an in-swinger, isn't it? It's just glorious. I think it's in the repertory of great Kevin De Bruyne passes. It's up there with the pass for Ilkay Gundogan, which we all remember, which was by one, which it was one of these moments. It's amazing. De Bruyne is a player. When we remember his career, we will remember his passes as much as his goals. That just says, you know, tells you everything you need to know about how complete and wonderful a player. But it was one of those moments, honestly, which make you gasp in admiration and forget about everything that's wrong with the world, because Kevin De Bruyne can do those kind of passes. It was glorious.
A few years back, I was researching an article about De Bruyne, and I found there was an old sort of TV pundit, I think it was in Belgium, who described him as, he has such vision that he can find not you and I with a pass, but he can find someone in a different TV studio down the road or some such, which I thought was very good. And this was definitely one of those. He found someone who was in an entirely different studio.
It's a capacity to have. I mean, he's got, they did some tests on him when he was, I think, 12 or 13 years old at Genk. And they found that his peripheral vision was completely off the scale, that nobody could quite understand. I wouldn't say he had the peripheral vision of an owl, but...
like a fish, like a gold. Is it eyes on the side of his head?
Like an owl, I like that.
Yeah, and but there is quite a difference between being able to see what is available and the capacity to imagine the pass and then execute it, and he can do all three.
It's a good...
extraordinary man.
I like it if Kevin De Bruyne's head just span around 360 degrees. Can owls' heads do 360? Can they? I mentioned Mo Salah, you know, playing in slow motion while the rest of us were in full speed. I thought Benjamin Mondi's goal was in slow motion while the rest of us were also in slow motion. It took a long time and all his teammates looked so surprised.
His first touch is appalling. I mean, it's an attempt at a dribble to go inside, but there's nobody there, so that's cool. And what I love is reaction. On Twitter, he tweeted something like hard work, perseverance, and so forth. If there anybody with a bunch of momentum, you think, hard work and perseverance. Anyway, it's good to see him back, to be honest, because he's been, I wouldn't say he's been missed, but it's perhaps one area in which Manchester City could do with some improvement, despite all the money they've spent on that position. And the kind of Mendy that we knew in the past would actually be able to fill that position.
An owl can move its head 270 degrees. Thank you.
Wow.
Producer Silas. Now, I watched more than I watched the De Bruyne pass. I watched Yuri Tielemans being the draft excluder a lot because it's the first draft excluder I've seen where he lay on his belly. So most of them lie on their side, but he was just flat down on his belly. And I wondered if that was because it's easier to get up quickly in the sort of press-up position than in a side plank. And it was and Tielemans really did bounce up quite quickly after being flat on his face. Arguably, if the wall jumped quite high, you could probably get the ball above Tielemans on his belly, in which case you'd need to get another player to lie on top of Yuri Tielemans, yeah, to have the double draft. That's if there's a really extreme draft, which I presume is if, I don't know, Philippe Coutinho is taking the free kick. Anyway, perhaps I've analysed that more than I needed to, judging by Barry's face. Leeds 2, Sheffield United 1. Some Leeds cliches that I'm meant to stop using. Fun, relentless, supremely fit, but they're all true. And I don't know if we need to overanalyze this game. We've got lots to talk about. And, you know, Sheffield United are relegated. Leeds are good and mid-table, with apologies to both sets of fans.
And Bielsa is still pissed off with something.
The best Mother's Day card I saw was one with Bielsa and the interpreter. And it just said, Marcelo says, Happy Mother's Day. You're lovely. With Marcelo looking at the ground. I thought it was tremendous. Anyway, no doubt we'll get yelled at by some Leeds and Sheffield United fans for our analysis of that game being a Mother's Day card. But it is what it is. Everton, Palace, Wolves, West Ham. Tonight, we'll talk about them on Wednesday's pod when we do the Champions League as well. Sid will join us in just a second to talk about La Liga. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. And now Valencia walked off the pitch in protest at alleged racist abuse directed at defender Mukhtar Diakabi by Cadiz's Juan Cala on Sunday afternoon, only to come back on again and complete the game without him after being informed they would have to forfeit the points if they did not return. Let's speak to Sid Lowe out in Spain. Hey, Sid.
Hi, Max. How you doing?
Yeah, yeah. Good, thanks. Can you explain exactly what happened then?
Yeah, I mean, I fear that we'll end up going around in circles, but let's try and start with the basics and then if you want, sort of work out from there. So the basics are that there's something said between Diakabi and Juan Cala. They jump for a long ball together. They're turning and heading back towards the other end of the pitch. And suddenly Diakabi turns and goes for Cala, who's still some distance away. So a couple of players get in the way. Gabriel Paulista is one of them. Cali, the defender from Cadiz, Kevin Gamedo. And they pull him away, and he is clearly absolutely furious. I mean, you know, this isn't just the sort of normal reaction. It's very much more than that. The referee comes and books him, and off the back of the referee booking him, it's quite an amazing thing to see, actually, because he seems to be sort of almost gone, if you sort of mean. It's beyond sort of a normal reaction. There's this kind of mix of, I mean, it's very difficult to judge from the outside, of course, but this kind of mix of disbelief, this mix of a sense of injustice. Anyway, he starts explaining to the referee and very kind of gesticulating enormously and sort of turning away and coming back again and throwing his arms up. Essentially what he does, of course, is we find this out later because the referee says this. He tells the referee that Juan Cala has called him Negro de Mierda, which is, it's not a perfect translation, but I suppose, and apologies for even saying this, I suppose it translates more or less as shitty black, more or less. And Valencia, there's a kind of a series of confrontations. He's still furious. He's still being held back. And Valencia, to cut a longer story short, decide to walk off the pitch, led largely by Gabriel Paulista, who of course used to play for Arsenal, and by the captain José Luis Gaya, who do this on behalf of Diakabi, and they lead him off the pitch. We haven't heard at this point, and we still haven't, by the way, what was said. We don't know the phrase. The one thing we see is that Gabriel is caught on camera, although I'm not sure if caught on camera is the right word. I think the right phrase is probably turned to the camera to make this point. And he basically says, Negro de mierda no, eh? In other words, you know, there's many things you can say, but you can't say this. You know, this is a phrase you cannot say. This is, you know, this is beyond the pale. So they lead them off. So the one glimpse we've got of what the phrase might be at this point is that one. They go off. At this point as well, Juan Cala kind of distances himself from everything. He's sort of standing apart from all of this. They go off. They're off for, I think in total, between the game stopping and the game restarting, I think it's 24 minutes. So they go off. There's a series of conversations down the tunnel. And then the thing that kind of makes us realise that they're going to start up again is that Hugo Guillamón comes out onto the pitch and starts warming up on his own. Now, Hugo Guillamón, like Diakabi, is a centre-back. So you're thinking, hang on a minute, they're warming up a centre-back. They're going to come back on, but they're not just going to come back on. They're going to come back on without Diakabi. They do. They come back on. They restart. Diakabi isn't playing and Juan Cala is. So Juan Cala comes out. He actually comes out later than the rest of the Cardiff players, but he comes out and they restart the game. So they restart the game. And of course, that's where you get the kind of the power of the imagery, which is obviously the completely wrong way around. You've got the alleged abused player sitting and watching as the abuser continues to play and everyone else continues to play. Now, Valencia have made this gesture of walking off on his behalf, but they come back on. So then, of course, you get into this discussion about, well, what happened? I don't know, Max, at what point you want to sort of stop me and ask questions rather than me continue with a very long kind of narrative here. But when they come back on, just as they come back on, you get a statement from Valencia on Twitter in which it says Diakabi was subject to racist abuse. So that's the first time we've had it confirmed that at least the accusation is that it's racist abuse. And in support of him, we're with him and we walked off. We're coming back on. We're playing because Diakabi has asked us to. So at that point, you think, OK, well, look, if this really is his decision, it may not be the way we would have done it. But if it really is decision, I suppose, you know, you sort of go with that, because anything that you do, and obviously it's very difficult to know what you do in this situation, but you would like to think that anything you do would always be driven by the player himself, always be driven by the victim. And what his real desire is. So they come back on. Now, just a slight aside here, just before they come back on, you see footage inside the tunnel. And Thierry Correa is clearly being consoled by Gonzalo Guedes. So for whatever reason, he's unhappy, whether it's because he's coming back out or whether it's just the whole incident, he's deeply upset. Anyway, they come back out and play. Later on, Valencia, and it's much later on, say, we came back out because we were forced to. Because we were going to drop points if we didn't play. This is after Gaia, post-game, the captain, had said, we came back out because we were told that if we didn't, we would possibly lose the 3 points and maybe more. And Diakabi basically authorised us to do this. Now, I want to make a point here, which is that I think there's a difference between Diakabi saying, please go and play for me, and Diakabi authorising you to play in the situation in which we might lose some points. Javi Gracia, the manager, says after the game, we spoke to Diakabi. We spoke to him and asked him how he felt, because we'd been told that if we didn't go back out there, we might lose 3 points. And he understood that we went back out, which is another step again from that original thing of Diakabi says, let's go and play. And then, as I say, after that, later on, you get that statement from Valencia saying we were forced to play because of the possibility of punishment, which is very different to what they'd said earlier on. And I must admit, I feel like Valencia, what they did initially was blame it on Diakabi and then blame it on the Federation and not blame it on maybe on their own decision-making process. And that's at club level, by the way, not at players level. So basically, they replay. Now, obviously, what happens with that final accusation is that the accusation essentially is that someone has said, and no one ever tells us who they is, by the way, someone has said, you must play or you will be punished.
So that could be the ref or it could be someone higher than that.
Now, without knowing, obviously, the absolute details of the conversation, the referee in Spain, the way that the protocol works is the referee does not cancel the game for racist abuse unless he or his team has heard it. If at that point a club says, we do not want to continue, then the referee says, OK, we don't continue. And at that point, he becomes an administrator. So he hasn't cancelled the game, they have. Of course, at that point, it's his duty to inform them of the possible consequences of this, which is not the same as threatening them. He says, right, listen, this is the protocol. If you don't want to continue, this will go to the competition committee. And obviously, the likelihood is, I think it's Article 142, but it doesn't really matter what number it is. The likelihood is you would lose the game, 6-0, and maybe there would be other sanctions. So at that point, of course, that's informing. That's not threatening. And I think it's worth making this point, because I think there is an assumption now that somehow the referee forced him back out. He doesn't because he can't. That's not his job to do that. At that point, he becomes an administrator. Anyway, they go back out and play. And of course, poses all sorts of questions about what they should have done. Because obviously, in a way, making a stand means we make the stand with all the consequences. If you want to take 3 points off us, take 3 points off us. Take 6 points off us. Take 100 fucking points off us. It doesn't matter. But Valencia felt, for whatever reason, that they had to go out. Now, this is Valencia's players and their coaching staff felt that they wanted to go out there. So the question, I suppose, is at what point is the decision made and by whom and under what kind of duress? The referee's report says, and referee's reports are very formulaic in Spain, so that's another thing I think to bear in mind here, says the two match day delegates came to me and told me they were going to return to the field of play. So in other words, it's a club decision. Because as I say, at this point, this isn't a decision for the referee to make. If he hears it or his team hears it, it is his decision to make. If not, he becomes an administrator. So they go back out and they play and Cardiff win. Now, just before you go into all the other questions, by the way, Cardiff's statement later on has been widely seen as they defended their player. I actually don't think they do. I think what they say is, look, we're against racism. Whoever does it, even if it's one of our players, there has to be the presumption of innocence, and we wait to see what happens to this. There isn't a determined defence of Kala. Cardiff are a club with, broadly speaking, a left-wing identity. Their fans, at least, have been involved in lots of anti-racism campaigns. So it makes me wonder if they actually might, if this is proven at some point, be pioneers in saying, okay, we'll hand down a punishment as well as just a federation one. Now, I'm speculating at that point, but given the kind of, if you like, the identity of the club. And we've heard nothing from Kala yet. Nothing at all. Now, he plays to a half-time, doesn't play in the second half. We've had no statement or denial or anything from him. Although on the pitch, you see him saying to the referee, there's nothing here, there's nothing being said.
Cadiz have just tweeted, about 15 minutes ago, Juan Kala will speak to the media on Tuesday after their training session. So it'll be interesting to see what he says.
Sid, he went over straight after the incident, walked over and had a word in his manager's ear, covered his mouth. Is there any knowledge of what was said there?
No, look, so Kala, you mean, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first thing is that in Spain, for many years now, players, and I think it's starting to happen in England, cover their mouths, whatever they're saying, all the time. Now, of course, in this whole incident, we haven't yet heard a recording of this, but these are empty stadiums and silent empty stadiums. So I suppose it's plausible that at some point we hear a recording of what was said. What the manager, Alvaro Cervera, the Cardiff manager, said after the game was that he had thought about taking Kala off then, but Kala had asked him to stay on and until halftime. And then at halftime, he does take him off. And it's very interesting, by the way, that, again, it's very difficult from the outside to see exactly what's going on. But every time the camera looked at Kala, you know, he sort of looked like an isolated man. You know, he mostly was standing alone, although there was a conversation, as you say, with the manager. There was then a conversation with the referee. But he kind of stands apart from it all. And when Cardiff come back out to do a 5-minute warm-up or a re-warm-up, if you like, before they restart, he doesn't come out with them. He comes out late. To the extent, and again, I realise that we're going around in circles, so apologies for this. Post-game, when Gaia is asked, did you ask Kala? Did you speak to Kala about whether or not he said it? He said, no, he came out last, so I couldn't speak to him. And of course, you wonder if that was maybe the reason. So Kala comes last, joins the game late, gets off quickly afterwards. And of course, what Gaia says, but I have absolutely no doubt this was said because Diakabi is so clear on it. And you know, you see the emotion and all the rest of it. Now, obviously, I suppose that's not our place to judge whether or not it's true. But in terms of that particular bit of conversation, Baz, I suspect it was about whether he continues. I mean, it may well have been about whether or not he actually said it. I honestly don't know the answer to that. And I think if you see what Cardiff have said, these are not really determined defences of their players. I think this is a club that's saying, basically, we have to see. We have to wait and see and then decide.
Thanks, Sid, because I think the detail really does matter. And I think it is important. And I think, it's interesting to think what protocols need to be there for this to be managed correctly. Or if club, because you can see it during a game, it's just very, there are lots of things they're thinking about. All these different people are thinking about, well, we're all here, we're playing this game. It's easier to finish this game rather than thinking, hang on, what is our... You wonder how many clubs are having these conversations before, now to say, look, what happens during a game if this happens? What do we do? It's not just in Spain, is it? We saw it with the Rangers Slavia Prague game as well. You know, what is what do we do as a set of players, as a club, as a team, etc.
Exactly. And also, you know, it's very easy, I suppose, to say what do we do and then decide that in the moment, because the moment is different. The degree of emotion in the response may be different from one player to another. You know, not all players will respond to abuse in the same way. You know, someone like Diakabi, who was clearly really, really upset, and as I say, Thierry Correa appeared to be as well. Maybe other players dealing with it differently. Maybe some black players abused would say to teammates, no, let's play. Maybe some would say, absolutely, we don't. I you know, that's not something that's easy to judge when you're in that scenario. As you say, there are then lots of people involved on lots of different levels. Of course, we saw this, didn't we, with Ancelotti in Italy and defending his player, but not sure exactly where you take this. And as for the protocols, I think there's an interesting sort of point here, which of course is that, as you say, look, you are confronted as a club with the possibility of losing the game because that's the protocols. And by the way, another point, sorry, those are protocols to do with abandoning a match. Those are not specifically, I believe, I really hope I'm not wrong on this, I believe those are not specifically protocols about abandoning a match because of racist abuse. Those are just about the protocols about abandoning a match. Then, of course, there's a committee that decides. So in other words, yes, this is, in terms of the protocol, in terms of the legislation, if you like, the impact of walking off is a 6-0 defeat, I believe, and then maybe other punishments. But of course, if you walk on this grounds, you're not just challenging the system. And of course, systems change by being challenged. So in a sense, you know, that's the step you're taking in the first place. You're not just challenging the system. There is another way of looking at it. And obviously, from the Federation and the league's point of view, it's another way of looking at it. And I don't know if this is overly benevolent towards them, but it's also an opportunity for them. So in other words, if you challenge the system, it's an opportunity for the league and the Federation to say, OK, here's our chance to prove that we do take this seriously. You will not get this 3-point ban. You will not get a sanction. We will deal with this. The problem is, of course, those protocols are there for a reason. Whether they're the right ones or not, they are the ones that they are. And I say, and you that system then maybe needs to be challenged so that it changes. It may well be that you could argue that it's not a problem with the protocol, because the protocol would have allowed last night Valencia to refuse to play, or even Cardiff to refuse to play, by the way, and then deal with it.
Elsewhere, Sid, whether it matters or as much, well, it doesn't matter as much. Whether it matters at all is a different question, but. There is league yes. with Atleti losing, you know, and Real Madrid and Barca sort of getting closer.
Yes, and not just Atletico losing, but this is part of a broader trend, isn't it? I mean, I think I hope I have got this statistic right. I believe they've only won 3 of their last 8 games. They're not actually getting beaten much, but they're drawing too often. They now have Real Madrid within 3 points of them. They have Barcelona, who play tonight, 4 points of them, so it could be just one. Clasico next weekend, which is good news for Atletico because it means at least they can't both win. But Atletico also go away to Betis next week now without Luis Suarez and without Marco Llorente, who are their best 2 players.
And the first of the Copa del Rey finals, a medal for Ødegaard.
Yes, it is a medal for Ødegaard. Yeah, he's one of the players that had got Real Sociedad there but weren't able to play the final because it took a year for them to play it because they'd waited for the fans. In truth, it was a really pretty poor final. I didn't know this, but there's a great football statistician in Spain called Mr. Chip, who came up with this stat. It's the first time a Copa del Rey final in Spain has ever been won 1-0 with a penalty. So there you go. It was the 1990 World Cup final, 1-0 with a penalty from Mikel Oyarzabal, who's the captain, who's only 23, has already played more than 200 games for the club. So it's a pretty fitting person to have won the final for them. But it wasn't a great game, but it doesn't really matter. It's their first trophy for 34 years.
Is he related to Mr. Chips from Catchphrase?
The thing is, Mr. Chip from Catchphrase says what you see. This guy gives you the stats that you don't see. So, okay. And as far as I know, he's also never been hidden behind lots of squares, quite clearly masturbating. Philippe is looking at me. This is a YouTube clip you've got to find. It's a brilliant clip of a Catchphrase episode where Mr. Chip is moving his arm in an unfortunate way.
Wouldn't it be Roy Walker's having a great time, isn't it? Wouldn't it be Senor Papas Fritas?
I suppose it probably would. Yeah.
Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
We'll get you back on again this week. Lots of Champions League to come, so we'll force you back on.
Nice one. Cheerio.
Cheers, Sid. From Spain to Ligue 1, Philippe, and PSG might not win the league.
I know. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it, that we always thought, we thought that the beginning of the season was just a bit of a hiccup. Pochettino was going to put everything right. But currently, after 31 rounds, we have Lille who have won against Paris Saint-Germain, deservedly so, with 66 points, PSG with 63, Monaco with 62, and Lyon with 61, with only 7 games to play. So it's all very exciting. And the way it happened as well is remarkable, because I don't know, when Neymar comes back, there's always something which happens when Neymar comes back from injury. And we know that's something he does quite often, to come back from injury. And this time it didn't disappoint us. Sent off at the very end of the game, following a second yellow card for a scuffle with a little player. The two players had to go at each other. So he might also, because he was already banned for one game, you know, one of those suspended sentences. So he might be suspended for a few games on top of the one he's going to get anyway for this red card, which means that PSG are in trouble. And 8 defeats already this season. They've lost at home to Marseille. They've lost at home to Lyon, to Monaco, and now to Lille.
But what happens to Pochettino if PSG don't win the league, and, you know, Bayern isn't, you know, they shouldn't beat Bayern.
It's almost unthinkable. I mean, to be honest, there are still 7 games to play, so there's still time to make up for lost ground. But whatever happens, when you compare this season with the previous ones, when PSG regularly won the league with 5, 6, 7 games to spare, it's a completely different ball game. And now they approach this game against Bayern, I think, with some trepidation, and rightly so. But for the French league itself, I have to say I'm really surprised by Lille, and also I'm starting to think that Christophe Galtier might actually be a bloody good manager, because if we talk about players and managers, quoting from another friend of ours we were talking about earlier, Galtier has had to make do with a team that has been a regular Champions League participant, losing their best players season after season after season, but they're always there or thereabouts. And now they're top of the league, and they look like they could go and the whole distance. Even though my money, Max, and yes, you're not a betting man, I know.
No, not anymore.
Not anymore. I would say that I'd think about Monaco for a second, because okay, Monaco sacked their manager, Moreno, at the beginning of the season. They got Niko Kovac, and, you know, whom we know from his time at Bayern. And they are playing very well. They're just behind the leaders. And I was actually wondering if it's a team, but that's for last to answer, which is a bit like a football manager's team from the 2010s, beginning of, because you've got Kevin Folland, Stefan Jovetic, Golovin,
yeah,
Ben Yedder, and Cesc Fabregas. And that's, you think, wow, yeah, actually, it's pretty decent, isn't it? I mean, as an attacking lineup, 5 years ago, it would have been one of the best in Europe.
Yeah.
It's like the Expendables, isn't it? It's like Sly Stallone and Dolph Lundgren and Arnie, age 70. Have they all had work done? Has Fabregas had fillers? That's what's happened. Now, obviously, PSG, you mentioned they're playing Bayern. Bayern took a big step towards winning the Bundesliga, didn't they, Lars?
Yeah, I realise we're running out of time, but very briefly, we have to have a tiny Rundfunk here, because there were two huge, huge games in the Bundesliga this weekend, first of which was, I think, Bayern Munich more or less winning the title. Julian Nagelsmann essentially conceded after the game. Bayern beating RB Leipzig 1-0 in a game that was actually pretty tight. RB Leipzig worked really hard and their pressing game was really good, but the problem that's haunted them all season, the lack of a clear goal scorer, was, you know, yet again an issue for them. And even without Lewandowski, Bayern got the 1-0 win with another goal from Leon Goretzka, or Leon Skoretzka, as I'm sure Thomas Müller would call him. But I mean, on a serious note, I mean, RB Leipzig, we're this deep into the season, they're second in the league and they're still fighting for the title. Their top scorer has 6 goals. Like, they have no goal scorers at all. And it's a problem for them. And I don't think you can win the league that well away. But they've done really good work to be as competitive as they have been. Second big game was Borussia Dortmund versus Eintracht Frankfurt. Frankfurt are now fourth. Dortmund are fifth. This was very much seen as a sort of a
a mini final for the Champions League spot, or certainly a game Dortmund needed to win to get the Champions League spot they need, and they didn't win. They lost. Frankfurt 1-2-1. All is bad in Dortmund. I think they are going to miss out on the Champions League as it looks, and then hanging on to Holland becomes very difficult.
And look, Jadon Sancho might be missing for those games against City. But Dortmund not in great form, and we'll discuss City's game with Dortmund on the pod on Wednesday. Zach says, how does Lucas Joao's miss rate on the Ronnie Rosenthal range, and was the passage of play the pinnacle of football? This was Reading against Barnsley in the Championship on Friday, full Football League programme, of which this was the absolute high point. I'm not sure, Barry, how he misses this.
Well, I watched this three times, and it was only on the third occasion that I actually realised he missed. It was quite astonishing. It wasn't as bad as Rosenthal's, but it wasn't too far off it.
It was quite good, wasn't it? Yeah. There's a bad back pass. There's a Reading player next to the keeper. He holds the keeper off. He's got a goal to the whole go to aim at, and somehow puts it wide. Anyway, check it out if you haven't seen it. Finally, Andy says, did Barry eat his Sunday roast?
Yes, eventually. But whenever I cook myself a nice roast, by the time it's ready, I don't really want it anymore because I've just cooked it. So I have to leave it for an hour and then go back to it.
Do you microwave it or have it cold?
I just either stick it in the microwave or the oven.
Okay. Or just heat the gravy. That's a good trick, isn't it?
That's not quite as effective.
Okay. Good to know. Well, look, that seems like enough for today, doesn't it? Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Philippe.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.